told about some of the early history of AA. He then shared a story about something like this, that he had made the commitment that when he made his first $1 million, he was going to take a trip around the world. He said when he made a $500,000, he just decided to go anyway. He said that he'd gone to New Zealand, a number of places in the Far East, and he said one of the best meetings he went to was when he was in Singapore. He said that there were some Malays there, some Hindus, and he said there was a group of people. I've been watching Les all the time Al was talking, and kind of a strange look was coming over Les's demeanor. And Al described this meeting, and he said there were some gentlemen came up off a boat to this meeting in Singapore. And Les said, I was one of those guys. And here shows how AA transcends the globe. Al meets Les in Singapore. They meet again in Boise, Idaho, and I meet them. And it's a big program. We went to Al's room and spun yarns that evening, and he described his family, and all of a sudden a link went through my mind, North Idaho. I said, would you be any relation to Bill Marinol? Bill Marinol was the then owner publisher of the News Review Publishing Company that published the Daily Idahoan in Moscow. I grew up and bought some of my shoes and socks selling the Daily Idahoan on the street for a nickel. And he says, yes, it was his brother. And the family of Marinaws are very well known in North Idaho. Without going on any further, I'm here to introduce you to Al Marinaw, 42 years sober, from North Hollywood, California.
He breaks my anonymity right off the bat.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much. He's Dr. Bill now, you know.
You know me real well.
Jim. I was thinking what I was going to say next. I'm always ahead of myself. My name is Al Marinaw, and I'm an alcoholic. And I have been sober 42 years and 4 months on Alcoholics Anonymous. The Philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am a Coeur d'Alene guy. I graduated from Coeur d'Alene High in 1920. I played basketball all over this area, and I was a musician also. I was a slide trombone player. We had great slide trombone players out of Coeur d'Alene, if you want to know it, and I was one. I don't know why the hell it was, but there was four of us that were real good. Then I got out of high school here, and I bummed around with a jazz band around Montana and there, and I decided to go to Idaho. I have a brother by the name of Lefty who was going to school there. And so I went down to Idaho and got a band going down there after I'd been out of high school about 2 years. And I got a band together, and then I had the pep band. If you ever heard of the Idaho pep band in the old days, you old goats remember that, I know. It was the greatest jazz band in the world. It was a big brass band, and we played nothing but jazz. And I don't know why the hell we dropped it, because we had a chance to go places. But that's all God's will. And then I went on the road after I got out of school. I went on the road with a band, and it was a very famous band called Art Landry, which is extinct now, of course. Right, that's 1,000 years ago. We made a record called Sleepy Time Gal in 1926 that outsold everything for Victor. And we were the second orchestra to record with an electric microphone. Now, mind you, that's how far ago it was. So I stayed with him a while, and then finally, I got married like a damn fool. And I ended up in Chicago, and I studied trombone with the greatest teacher in the world, an old bohemian. I was with him for 5 years. And Metronome magazine came out with an article about the great trombone players of the day, and I was one of them. And that was very bad for an alcoholic, I'll tell you. The ego was something to behold. And I played at the World's Fair, and then I went down to Spokane here for a year with my own band. And I was drunk all that year. I hardly remember much about it. And then I went down to Los Angeles where the Big Sugar was and played in the studios, and I had a fine reputation, of course, and a lot of my friends were there. That's where I ended up down there, making that fat sugar in the studio. And I got out of music in 1955. The studios of MGM where I worked, we did 300 pictures a year. Now they're doing 30 on account of TV has ruined everything down there. And I don't think you want to hear a hell of a lot more about me, do you? I'll get back to it. We'll pick up the strings as we go along. I'm the sort of a speaker that just goes as I feel. Now, a lot of my dear friends down there that are fine talkers, they've got some fine talkers in Los Angeles, but they can their pitch. They memorize the pitch for 50 minutes, and they give the same thing all the time. And I talk as I feel, you know? I talk as I feel. And, you know, I feel right now like I want to mention something to you. We talk a great deal about anonymity. And I'd like to get this off my chest right now because there's a great deal of discussion about breaking our anonymity. It says at the level of press, radio, and films, it doesn't say anything about at our group meetings. I'm getting started. I'll be here till 2 o'clock, so just sit back and relax. It's so wonderful to talk in your hometown, really. I mean, you can't imagine the feeling I have. Dr. Bob's comment on the anonymity of AA. The tradition says we need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. Dr. Bob, the co-founder of AA, commented on tradition 11 as follows. Since our tradition on anonymity designates the exact level where the line should be held, it must be obvious to everyone who can read and understand the English language that to maintain anonymity at any other level is definitely a violation of this tradition. The AA who hides his identity from his fellow AAs by using only a given name violates the tradition just as much as the AA who permits his name to appear in the press in connection with the matters pertaining to AA. I think that kind of tells us, doesn't it? Huh? Now, for instance, me being a musician, and I had a reputation as the best drunken trombone player in Hollywood. And after I got into AA, I hadn't worked for quite a while, now believe me. And after I got into AA, I'm working at MGM, which was the big and the most money out there. And they always put the music to the picture, the last thing, and they worked the ass off us. I mean, we would work all night till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And this particular picture, I was working out there, and maybe 4 or 5 months after I got into AA. And the brass section is the ones that get drunk first, you know. So we had a little bar way in the back of the sound stage. So this particular night, I had just gotten into AA a few months, and all the guys were saying, come on, just have one drink. And I says, no, I'm not drinking. Well, what made you stop? I says, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, what the hell is that? I says, we don't drink. We don't go in the wagon. We don't do anything. We just don't drink. So after a while, the first trombone player, a very dear friend of mine, Randy, that anonymity thing, you know, means that we don't break somebody else's anonymity. That's the big thing. That's the no-no. But Randy, the first trombone player, who was a dear friend of mine, came over and says, he was drunker than hell, and he says, don't pay any attention to these bastards. He says, they're all jealous because you're sober, and I am too. And I'm going to give you a buzz one of these days. I want to find out about this thing. So I said, okay. About 3 months later, Randy called me up. And now he's got damn near 42 years of sobriety on Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. And at this particular meeting that night out at the Ebell Club in Balboa a couple years ago, there were three other musicians that I sponsored. And when we sat down and figured out there were about 150 musicians who were sober because I broke my anonymity at that level. Now you see what it means to us? I don't mean at the level of press, radio, film, and TV. I just mean among ourselves. Everybody on my block knows I'm a member of AA, where I live. Everybody around there knows that I'm a member of AA. All the musicians know I'm a member of AA, so I get lots of those guys still do. So you see, this is a pretty important thing, and I'm just telling you because I've been around 42 years and I know a little bit of something, you know. You know, this stuff didn't come out till I'd been sober by 12, 14 years, all this, the 12 traditions. They came out long, long after I got sober up. I'm an alcoholic. I have the disease of alcoholism. I wanted to get sober long before AA came along. And when Alcoholics Anonymous came along, it gave me a 100% guarantee. Gave me a 100% guarantee that I would never drink again. If I lived according to certain conditions, as honest as I possibly could. Alcoholics Anonymous gives us all a 100% guarantee that we will never drink again. If we live according to certain conditions, which are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as honest as we possibly can. And a lot of us say, I haven't the ability to be honest anymore. But it says in the book, the willingness to try to be honest alone will do the job. And we who honestly want to stay sober, and I accent the word honestly because this is the basis of our foundation, of our sobriety. This is the very foundation of our sobriety, honesty. We who honestly want to stay sober, try to live according to these 12 spiritual steps, I will say. Because they're all good, they're all God, they're all positive, so they're spiritual. We don't realize that at the time, naturally. And lo and behold, strange and wonderful things happen. We stay sober. But our family and our close friends notice long before we realize that there's been a definite change in our attitude towards ourselves and our attitude towards others. In other words, there's a definite personality change. We don't realize it. And we stay sober. And we stick with it. And then we keep studying this thing and studying this thing. And Alcoholics Anonymous is on the 12 steps. And the three pertinent ideas that follow. That's the whole thing in one ball of wax, if you want to believe it. Bill wrote in there, A, I am an alcoholic and cannot manage my own life. And B, that probably no human power could help me. And I tried them all, so there was no human power could help me. And C, that God could and would have sought. Now they say, if he were sought. But when I wrote it, it was it sought. God could and would have sought. So you say to yourself, well, what... I'm staying sober. How am I seeking God? And all we have to do is a little bit of reviewing, you see? If we could live these 12 pertinent, if we could live these 12 steps, these spiritual steps, as honest as we possibly could, we would be living like God would want us to live. And who is God? God is a power outside of a human power. AA is so wonderful, you can pick anything you want. You can be a Buddhist, you can be anything. You can be a Mohammedan, everybody has their own God. That's fine. So you say, well, there's Christian gods and the Mohammedan gods and all kind of gods. It doesn't make any difference. It's a power outside of ourselves. God is all and all is God. So I said to my little nephew, who is a Jesuit priest, I said, Joe, who's God? He says, anyone that you desire outside of a human power, some power outside of ourselves. And he says, we have a lot of Indian blood in us. And I said, yeah, about a third, I guess. He said, what's the matter with the Great Spirit? Be your God just as well as any. It works very beautifully. You see how basically common sense Alcoholics Anonymous is? All down to earth, good old-fashioned common sense. So we try to the best of our ability to practice these 12 spiritual steps, and we are trying to live according to God's will. And I didn't realize it for 5 years. Believe me, that's how stupid I am. I didn't know why I was staying sober. And then we get talking about these three pertinent ideas, and finally we find out. And I had a spiritual awakening and didn't even know it. They
see, they talk about these sudden spiritual awakenings, you know. Well, some ding-dongs have this. In fact, my old friend Jack had a spiritual awakening. And it was actually just the way it's supposed to be, you know. Of course, he's drunk now, but that was the way. But 99% of us, it is the change in our personality, our attitudes, and our sense of values. That is the true spiritual awakening. Page 569 of the big book, read that. I wrote the last paragraph in that thing, so I wrote the book. You know how it is. I was criticizing Bill Wilson, and he says, well, write one better, and I did, and he put it in. Because of that, every time he'd write a book, he'd send it to me to edit it, you know, and I'd write it, I'd write over perfect, right, and send it back to him. I didn't know nothing about editing, nothing, you know. But because I criticized this one little thing, why, he said, I got a lot of books for you. From Bill Wilson, typewritten. It's great. Well, the first group I came into, and the first group west of the Rockies, were 34 members. And they're all men except one, and that was Sybil. The only girl in the group. They're all older guys. They were 40 years or older. At that time, 40 years was older to me. There were four of us that were less than 40 years. And they were mean old guys, all of mean old guys. We had some guys that were still working, but a lot of them were still sleeping in parked cars, you know, one of those things. This was a very, very good group. We had the book and nothing else. So the... We didn't have anybody from New York to guide us, thank God. So the founder of this group, which was the first group to live, his name was Mortimer J. He's still alive. And Mort says, I think we have to have a format for this meeting. And he says, I think it's a good idea to read a portion of Chapter 5 and the 12 Steps. And we all approved. And then some ding-dong back there, most likely was a religious fanatic, said we ought to recite the Lord's Prayer, and my God, it hit the fan. Now we're going to have another cult, have another religion. After all, there were just between 400 and 500 members of AA in the whole United States at that time. So we were really grasping, you know. Well, my God, those guys in the back row got to fighting, and one guy hit the other guy over the head with a chair, and I thought, this is wonderful. I think I'll come back, you know? Now, we had a guy at the door. They did. I mean, I was very new. They had a guy at the door who had, he screened everybody that came. We were very jealous of this. And when a guy would come to the door, a stranger, he'd say, do you want to stay sober on an all-time basis? And the guy hesitated a little bit. He said, get the hell out and make up your mind. We don't want you in here. We had two guys in the group that kept getting drunk on us all the time. And they'd go to a bar and they'd tell everybody they were members of AA and they were ruining our reputation. So the steering committee of the group had a meeting out on the corner after one of the meetings one night. We met every Friday night. It was the only meeting in California then. And we passed a law. Thank goodness you know we don't have any laws in AA. Everything is suggested. We passed a law. Anybody that got drunk twice can't come to AA anymore. He's out for life. So thank God we had a guy by the name of Pete Cunningham, because I could name them all but a couple that they're all dead. Old Pete got up at the next meeting the next Friday night and he says, you know, I think we made a mistake last Friday night. He said, I've been looking through the book and looking through the book and I can't find anywhere where we have a right to bar anybody from AA, no matter what. It says in the book, anybody with an alcoholic problem is welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't say anything on how many times they get drunk, and we had to let those guys back in. Terrible thing. It broke us, broke our heart. I was up in Santa Maria, not St. Mary's. I was in Santa Maria recently, and I'm just going to bring, because you're a sophisticated audience and you catch jokes very easy, so I'll tell you this little joke. Last 1955, they opened an AA club in Santa Maria. Santa Maria is kind of one of my favorite towns anyway. I got some very dear friends there in AA. And there was the other speaker was a guy by the name of Jim Burwell. Now, Jim Burwell was one of the four first AAs. He was one of the only AAs that was an AA when the book was written. They say 100 people got sober. That is baloney. Don't believe it. There were just four of them sober when the book was written. And they had to raise some money, so they wrote a book. This goes on. I'll be here at 2 o'clock. You won't have... We're going down to Moscow. I'm going to pick up my... I got a nephew down there. He's loaded with dope. I've got 3 automobiles. He's going to give me one when I'm up here. Dr. Mano. Isn't that something, doctor? I've got 2 or 3 nephews that are doctors. The family's improved from the sawmill over here where we used to work. So, Jim, we became very dear friends. Jim moved to San Diego from Philadelphia. And we used to talk together a lot. Jim was a wonderful speaker, but he wouldn't get off his fanny. He just didn't want to be bothered about going out and talking. But we got him to go. He and Rosa, his wife, she was a firebrand. So there was a guy came up and I spoke to him a couple months ago. I don't need the damn thing. No, it's still going. All right, fine. So this fella came down this night that I was speaking there a couple months ago, and he had a tape. And it was a tape that Jim and I made in 1955. And Jim sounded wonderful on this tape, but I was right up there with him because I told a story. And I'm going to tell it to you. It's a sophisticated story. They laughed. They laughed in Santa Maria. Guys, we'll kill them up here. This fella had a beautiful bar. He had a gorgeous bar, but he wasn't getting any money. He was no business. So one day, some deaf and dumb people came in, and pretty soon all his business was from Denny's, deaf and dumb people. So he learned to speak the language with his hands with him. Smart guy. And they started coming in, and pretty soon about 80% of his business were deaf and dumb people. This particular Wednesday afternoon, and I say Wednesday because it's usually slow on Wednesday. There was one guy sitting at the end of the bar, and 3 of these deaf and dumb people came in. And they were about half loaded anyway. And they sat down, and they ordered a drink with their fingers, and he got them a drink, and they ordered another one, he gave them another one, and pretty soon they're sitting there together, and they're looking at one another and giggling, and they're going like this with their fingers all together. And they look at the bartender, and he said, no, no, no. So they stopped, and pretty soon they're at it again. And about the 3rd time they did it, he went around the end of the bar, and he threw them out. And he comes back in the bar, and he's cussing like hell. And the guy at the end of the bar says, what'd you throw them out for? He says, listen, if I've told them once, I've told them 1,000 times. No singing in this bar room. That first group I came into, we grew very fast, and we moved over to a big hall at 2200 West 7th Street. And as Jim was telling you, we had about 600 members there at one time. It was fantastic, fantastic. It was a big group on the West Coast and no help from New York, and it was just out of this world. And we brought Bill Wilson out here, and he stood up on the stage and cried, and he says, I can't believe that AA came across the mountains just with the book alone. And he went back to New York and he went into a 5-year depression. And that's true. So we had a meeting from 8:30 to 9:30, open. And then at 9:30 we'd have a closed meeting and all the non-alcoholics would go upstairs and they had their own meeting. And they had called it the non-alcoholic family group. And my wife, Cecilia, was involved in this. And this is how Al-Anon started, right there at 2200 West 7th. Because Bill came and he got a load of it and he sent Lois out. And we had pictures where they had Lois at this deal, and it was quite a thing. So Al-Anon really started there. You see, all the big stuff starts west of the Rockies. Especially in AA. You know, one time we were having a lot of trouble with a guy who was starting a group. He was starting groups all over, and he was using these people. You know, you can use people. And so we incorporated AA in the state of California. Nobody could start a group unless we left. And better minds started working, and we threw out the incorporation. Yeah, we're going to stop them right now. Then the group grew to be about 600 people. And the second meeting would go to 11:30. They say, no souls are saved after 10 o'clock. To hell they aren't. 2 o'clock in the morning sometimes. And after the meeting, why, we had these big long tables at this beautiful hall, and we would have coffee and donuts till 2:30 in the morning. And this is like New Year's Eve. And this was the advent of Alcoholics Anonymous on the West Coast. And then the war came along, and all the people that came from Santa Barbara and Bakersfield and from miles and miles away couldn't come anymore on account of the lackage of gas. If you remember, some of you goats are as old as I am, I know, when we couldn't get gas except by stamps back in the early 40s. So they started their own groups, and we had 1,000 of them down there, I guess, 1,000 groups. That doesn't mean that we have a better percentage of sobriety, because we have a little trouble with lots of other things. When a guy gets up and says, I'm an addict and an alcoholic, I scream. I said, I'm an addict too, I'm addicted to alcohol, so I don't say anything about it. So we have our problems too, of course. I went to Los Angeles from Chicago in 1934, and my wife was a very intolerant woman. We had 2 little girls, and she would just go into, well, if I didn't come home for 3 or 4 days, she'd just flip her lid. And it got so terrible, you know, the latter part there, where she would have divorce papers laying on the table when I'd walk in. Now, when you've been on a drunk for 3 or 4 days, maybe down at Tijuana or somewhere, and you come home and you need nothing but sympathy and a cool hand on your forehead and a hold your head while you puke, and then you walk in and you find divorce papers, you can imagine what a terrible, terrible shock that was to me. Across the street was another drunk by the name of Jack. Jack was a very, very wonderful musician. Perfect pitch, arrange, compose, play all the reed instruments beautifully, and he was the worst drunk I ever met in my life. And old Jack and I, we formed an AA group all our own before AA was ever on the picture. It was one alcoholic helping the other. If I was dying in the morning and I had to get to the studio, I'd call across the street to Jack. I'd say, make the run or get me some medicine and get over there with a jug and cool me down. Give me some medicine. By the same token, I did the same thing for Jack. Where 2 or more are gathered together. Jack was a terrible drunk. He used to stay in bed when he drank. I never... How do you get any fun out of that, Jack? You know, he'd say, I don't get pinched. Down around the corner was a liquor store. Old Sam Cohen owned a beautiful liquor store. And being a smart alcoholic, I wanted to set myself up a charge account, which we called a cuff. So I got old Sam cuffed up to 2 jugs, and he wouldn't cuff for anymore. And I told Jack, old Sam is tough as hell. He won't cuff me for over 2. And he says, well, most likely you don't work him right. And I said, why? He says, I owe him $500. I says, oh, my God, how'd you get him up to $500? He says, by using my head, dummy. He says, I owed him 20, paid him 10, owed him 40, paid him 20, owed him 100, paid him 50. Of course, it took me quite a while, but I got him on. One day we're both dying for a drink, and Jack says, let's see Sam. And I says, oh, Sam ain't going to give us anything. He says, watch me work. He goes over and says, Sam, give us a jug of so-and-so. And Sam says, Jack, I can't do it. You owe me $500 now, and I have to have it right now. He says, I'm going bankrupt, man. He says, with the taxes and the debts I've got, he says, I have to have that $500. Can't you hock your instruments? He says, they're in hock. Bored from friends and all that. This just went on and on and on. Finally, old Sam made a big mistake. He says, why don't you go down to the bank and borrow it? And Jack says, you mean on a personal note? And Sam says, yeah. He says, well, I need a co-signer on that. Sam says, I'll co-sign. We got our job. Long about now, things are getting very bad. My friends, now, of course, I had a lot of them in the studios. A lot of guys from Idaho, though, work in the studios down there. They used to play for me at Idaho that were there long before I was. And things were getting very, very bad. My family and my friends were on me, you know, to get off that cliff. Drink like I do. Did you ever hear that word? Why don't you drink like I do? Jesus, I could kill them when they say that. Why don't you drink like I do? Take a couple drinks tonight and go to bed. What the hell fun do you get out of that? Drink it all or don't drink at all. And then they say, why don't you eat after you drink? Spoil all that good feeling? It cost me so much money. You know, passed me out. I was a blackout drinker. I'd black out for a week at a time. I was a terrible, terrible drunk. Terrible drunk. Come off a drunk and, oh my God, I want to kill myself. And I'd run down and look at the front end of the car to see that I didn't kill anybody. There wasn't any blood or flesh on it. You've been through it. You know what it is. It was pretty rough. Pretty damn rough in those days. You know, in those days, alcoholism was not considered an illness or a disease. And a drunk was really, he was in bad shape. He had it real bad. You couldn't get into a hospital. You couldn't get into a veteran's hospital. So the drunks, they loaded them in the nut houses like Camarilla down there and the jails. And as he worked forces out on the loads, and this is where the drunks, you know, American Medical Association did not recognize alcoholism as a disease. And these guys, you poor bastards, are committing suicide, and one thing or another, was a pretty rough deal. And I was right in the middle of all that. And then, you know, we had a senator from Iowa. I can't break his anonymity. I just got through telling you about that. You can't break somebody else's anonymity. But he was a senator from Iowa, along about the late 40s. And he got a bill through Congress for $350 million to take care of the drunks. Rehabilitation. And you know, the day after he got that bill through, American Medical Association decided that alcoholism was a disease. Now all our hospitals have an alcoholic department. That's soft, though. How easy you got it nowadays. We didn't have it like that. It was pretty, pretty bad. And the drunks, we went in a cycle. We'd take a cure, and then we'd take psychiatric treatment, and some of them would end up with a religion. And some of them shouldn't have ended up with a religion. They got crazier on religion than they did on the booze. They'd have been better off. So, a friend of mine, a musician friend of mine, old Andy Segrist, he's dead now. We were with Paul Whiteman together one time, and I always said Andy was the worst drunk than I was. Andy took a cure, and by golly, stayed sober. And I said, what's the cure? He says, Halco, out in the Culver City. So when I was really desperate, I called up Halco, and they charged me $150. And the guys came and got me in no time at all. They took me out there, and I'm sick, and I'm dying. And I got a picture coming up the following week that meant a lot of money to me, and I had to get sober. I did pictures like Gone with the Wind and Duel in the Sun. I did a lot of good pictures. I mean, I was in the band, first of all in the band. But anyway, I got this big picture coming up, and I have to get myself in shape, and I'm dying. They got me out there, and the doctor, they took all my clothes away from me, and the doctor checked me out for my heart and my blood pressure and everything, and he said, I says, oh, what are you going to do, doc? And he says, oh, we're just going to give you the cure. Just give you the cure. And I said, well, what do you do? And he says, oh, we cure you up in good shape. Don't worry about that. He says, don't worry about that. They gave me one of these little short nightgowns, you know, those little short ones. They put me to bed, and I'm shaking. I'm sick. I'm dying. So there's four nurses standing out there, you see. And there's the two men and two women. And the men were gay, so we had four women. The gays will kill me. So, well, I was sure taken down the line by a gay for saying that, but that's all right. One of them, he swished in with a platter of booze and asked me what my choice was, and I said what it was, and I'm sick, and they hold me up, and they throw that booze down my throat, gave me all I wanted to drink, and I got drunk as a goat. My head went over the side of the bed. Well, first they hit me in the chest with that apomorphine. It's a stuff that makes you sick no matter what you drink. And I never threw up and puked so much in my life, but it was so bad my eyeballs were driving on the floor. It was awful. I could have knocked them out. And I I knew it wasn't the booze that made me that sick, because us old billiard drinkers, we don't get that sick on just booze. And then they took me to another room and they gave me 16,000 high animus.
Oh, God.
And then they put me back to bed and they gave me something to make me perspire, and I soaked through the bed. And this was just one treatment. And I got one of these every 4 hours for 3 days and three nights. And believe me, when I got out of that joint, I was as pure as the day I was born. And I was drunk in a month. Then the next thing, sometime later, why my friends and my family encouraged me to go to a psychiatrist. So they picked out a guy who was supposed to be a great psychiatrist from Europe. He couldn't speak English very well. You couldn't pronounce his name, but he was a hell of a nice guy. So we had three seances together, this guy, right? And he said, I was sober, of course, and he says, there's nothing the matter with you. He says, you're a superior intelligence. He says, you're just wasting your money. I says, thank you. He says, why did you come in the first place? I said, because my family and my friends just dogged me to do it, and I figured I'd better come. It's like John. John lived in this town about the size of Coeur d'Alene, and he had a wonderful family. All drunks come from wonderful families. Did you ever know that? You see a drunk wobbling down the street, and all the old biddies will say, and then look at him, and he comes from such a nice family. So John's wobbling down the street, and his family talked him into going to the psychiatrist. So he went to him, and he took treatment after treatment, and nothing happened. So finally, the psychiatrist says, John, we're not making any headway. You're drunk all the time. He says, all I want you to do is to answer my questions honestly. And he says, what would happen to you if I cut off your left ear? And John says, my hearing would be impaired about 50%. He says, that's right. Now we're getting somewhere. Now, what would happen to you if I cut off your right ear? And John says, I wouldn't be able to see. He says, what? Why wouldn't you be able to see? He says, my hat would fall down over my eyes. Then my next venture was religion. Now, we moved from Los Angeles up to Tujunga. My oldest daughter had asthma. We moved up there, and it was a lonesome, lonesome place away back there. And I met a Catholic priest up there by the name of Dennis Falvey. Now, I was raised a Catholic, but I hadn't been to church for 20-some years. I was a fallen away Catholic, you call it. He's pretty good, too, you know. So this guy's name was Falvey, Dennis Falvey. They called him Father. I never called him Father. I called him Dennis. He was a hell of a nice old guy. And I'd get drunk, you know, and I'd bum $5 or $10 off him. And he never once says, why don't you quit drinking? I says, this guy must have been a drunk himself. You know, and he quit. He talked me into getting a choir together for him at the church. And, you know, sometimes I wouldn't show up, and I'd be at his back door, bum and door for him. And he was a wonderful, wonderful man. Maybe one of the greatest guys I've ever met. Most tolerant, most likely. Well, Christmas came along, and I got myself into an awful jam. I've been sober a couple months. I used to stay sober sometimes a month, month and a half at a time. But I made up for it, you know, I made up for it. And this time I've been sober for 2 or 3 months, and I bought a car, and everything's going fine. Christmas is coming along, and we bought stuff for the kids. We're going to open our Christmas presents at 7 o'clock Christmas Eve. And everything is going to be wonderful. Everything is going to be great. That's dough in the pocket and everything. And about the day before Christmas, I got a call. 2 days before Christmas, I got a call from Republic Studios, where they make the Hell Horse Operas, you know, the Western, see? And Gene, what's his name that owns the...
Autry.
Gene Autry made billions of dollars there at Republic. Gene Autry couldn't sing in tune, you know? So what we do, he would sing his songs for the picture with a guitar. And you could get a little out of tune, and then you couldn't hear it. And then we'd put earphones on, and we'd take this tape, and we'd put earphones on, and we'd play the music to back him up. And we'd play the music, and then we'd mark our music. And when he went sharp, we'd go sharp with him. And when he flat, we'd go flat, and we'd mark it. So we'd go along, we'd go... We made $1 billion, that guy did on that. Well, they had a big party, and I went down to the party, and when I was leaving the house, the wife says, don't drink over 3 scotch and sodas. I says, I'm not drinking anything. And that's up on a hill. And on the way down that hill going towards Republic that afternoon, the day before Christmas, I kept saying to myself, she ought to know how much I can drink. How crazy can you be?
Ah, I won't take one drink.
What's the use? Well, I did my bit at this place, and they had great big long bar where you helped yourself, and they had food over here. Of course, all those fat fiddlers, they ate the food. All those brass men were over at the bar. Oh, come on, have a drink, Alan. I says, no, I'm not. I got a big deal going. I have to be at high mass in the morning, and I'm going to open the presents for my kids. And you know what happened. Somebody came up, and somebody else says, I don't care if I do. When I woke up, I was in the county jail, and I smashed my car all to hell. Typical alcoholic trick, you know? Typical. The most important spot in the whole year, and I'm drunk and in jail. So I called up a lawyer who was an ex-musician. Bunny Cohen was his name. We played together. Now I call him up Christmas morning. Don't ever get pinched in that area and be in jail on Christmas morning. The Salvation Army is right outside of your cell beating that damn drum and screaming, man. You feel like the lowest thing that was ever on this earth. I mean, it was terrible. So I call up Bunny and I says, come down and get me out. And he says, I'll be down today. And he didn't get down there till 9:30 Christmas night. And I says, where the hell have you been? He says, I was drunk myself. I'm so drunk to come down and get you off. Of course, I went to the old priestodex after lots of things happened. Lots of things happened. It's at 2 o'clock. I'll cut that down to 1. And I went down to the old boy down there, and I says, Dennis, I understand that you can take a pledge and quit drinking. And he says, oh, yeah, a lot of people take pledges and quit drinking, but he says, not you. And I says, what do you mean? He says, well, you're one of those guys. And I said, what do you mean, one of those guys? He says, Al, I can't explain it. But your kind of people are the greatest people in the world when you're sober. But when you're drunk, I don't want to be around you. I said, well, did you ever hear of anybody like me who ever got sober? And he says, yes, one guy in my whole life. Had a little church in South Dakota, in the town drunk. He said he had what we call a sudden spiritual awakening. But he says he woke up one morning and he was absolutely a different personality and a really wonderful little guy. And he said he stayed sober and we made him mayor of the town. But he says, that's the only person that I ever saw that's like you that ever got sober. I says, that's fine. And I started walking away and he says, just a minute, I want to tell you something. What's going to happen to me? He says, oh, you're going to die in the gutter. No doubt. He says, just no doubt. So I says, fine. I started walking away, and he says, just a minute, I want to tell you something before you go. He says, you see, it's not a sin or a moral vice to drink, but it's a sin and a moral vice to be a glutton. And that's as much as I can help you, and that's as much as any honest man in the cloth can help you. It's not a moral vice to drink. So I went my way. And then my wife got a divorce. God was good, but I didn't know it. I said, now I'm a failure again. Failure in marriage. And I got back to Hollywood. It wasn't a matter of just a few years, 2-3 years, and I drank myself out of everything. And I'm right down the tubes. Pretty desperate guy. And I ended up in the south side of Los Angeles in Venice and Arlington in a $2-a-week room above a grocery store. This is my skid row. This is where I live. Wasn't good. And I was lonesome. And all my friends had deserted me. Guys I'd helped all my life. See me coming down the street and across the street to avoid me. I'm walking up alleys. I get a job at one of the Class C studios and the damn collection agency would get my check before I'd get to it. They'd garnish. They knew where I was going to work before I did. $15 a week unemployment in those days. I had an old boiler. I had an old car, 34 Pontiac, straight 8 convertible. You'd think a steam engine was coming on the street, right? The fenders were rattling. I'm really lonesome. I'm tired. I'm sick. I'm getting pinched all the time. Driving without a license. I never gotten any wrecks, but I always got on the side streets and I'd go real slow. And the cops would pinch me. They figured I was casing some joint to rabbit, you know? Everything was very, very bad. And then I met a gal by the name of Cestadia, whose husband had just died, and she had a little girl. And she was working. And we buddied right up together right away. And we've been together ever since. In fact, we've been married 42 years, Cestadia and I. She was lonesome and I was lonesome, and it was just the thing that I needed. And she was very, very tolerant, and she drank with me, but she was a lousy drunk. You know, her knees would get weak. And you know where she'd fall. Anyway, things were very, very bad. And finally, I got myself into a bad jam. And I got a lawyer, and the lawyer says, for $250, I'll keep you out of jail. And 3 or 4 days later, he called again. He says, you know something? He says, did you ever see a record down there? And I said, no. And he says, well, he said, I need another $250, he said, because I got to grease a lot of palms. And I wasn't able to raise the $250. So I called my brother Bill down in Moscow. And Bill had always been a sort of a father to me. There were 10 in our family. I'm the youngest boy. And old Bill told me on the phone, he says, if they're... And I got a lawyer, and the lawyer says, for $250, I'll keep you out of jail. And 3 or 4 days later, he called again. He says, you know something? He says, did you ever see a record down there? And I said, no. And he says, well, he said, I need another $250, he said, because I got to grease a lot of palms. And I wasn't able to raise the $250. So I called my brother Bill down in Moscow. And Bill had always been a sort of a father to me. There were 10 in our family. I'm the youngest boy. And old Bill told me on the phone, he says, if they put you in San Quentin and keep you sober, that's the place for you, and he hung up. I says, my God, my ace in the hole has deserted me. Everything has deserted me. So anyway, I was pled guilty, and I got 90 days, and I got out in about 40, 45 days. I went back to this room, and I says, if I ever drink again, I'm going to commit suicide. And I meant it. And I stayed sober a month. And something happened. And we alcoholics have that great ability to make mountains out of molehills better than any other class of people in the world. The least little thing will happen to us, and we just keep building it up and building it up and building it up. And that happened to me. And I was like all alcoholics. I jumped on that horse, and I rode in all directions. I rode in all directions. I was like the squirrel in the cage, going around and around and around and around. Catty corner from where I lived, there was a bar and a liquor store, and I had a good cup over there. And the bartender was a drunk, so that was good. And I started on this last drunk of mine. And it was the worst drunk I was ever on. I lost 30 pounds. I was a walking zombie. I didn't remember from 1 10 minutes to the other where I was or what I was doing. I was trying to commit suicide by drinking, and I would have accomplished it, too. Well, I guess God's will was on my side, because I got a call after I'd been drunk for several weeks. Celia couldn't get me to eat anything. Nobody got ever ate anything. I was just going. Old Jack across town called me up on March 1st of 1941. And he says, have you seen the Saturday Evening Post this week? And I said, no. And he says, well, there's an article in there about a group of people in New York called Alcoholics Anonymous. They help one another. And he says, you know something? They've stole our idea. I said, why? He says, well, it shows a guy lying in bed in the picture, and another fellow's looking down at him, and most likely that guy brought him some medicine. And when that guy in bed is well and this other guy's on his tuckus, he goes and helps him. And he says, the most amazing thing about it, there's 100 of them. And I says, oh, no. He says, oh, yes. I says, like a union, a drunkard's union. He says, that's it. I says, that's wonderful. Read me some more. He says, well, I'm pretty drunk, and my eyes won't focus on that small print right now. So I kept right on drinking, and a few weeks later, old Jack called me up, and he says, I found this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I says, yeah, what about it? He says, they don't drink. I says, they don't drink. He says, no. I says, that's wonderful. Well, tell me. He says, well, I was down at the liquor store cupping for a jug of wine, and one of the local drunks was paying part of his bill. And I got him aside, and I said, what are you paying your bill for? You want to ruin it for the rest of us? The guy says, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, we don't drink, and he says, we make amends, and I'm making amends. And he says, so I went to a meeting with him, and he says, you know, I've been sober a whole week. And I says, oh, my God, the worst drunk in the world, and you've been sober a whole week. I'm a cinch for a lifetime. I says, well, send him over. I want to talk. So he said, well, he said, you'll have to call him and ask him to come over. So he gave me his name. I'm trying to think of it. It doesn't make much difference. So he gave me his name, his phone number, and I called him, and he says, I'll be over tomorrow afternoon. And I says, don't come in the afternoon. He says, why? I says, I'll be passed out. Why will you be passed out? I says, I'm passed out at noon every day, or I have the DT. So, but the damn fool came 3 or 4 times. And I was passed out, just like I promised him. So we argued and fought on the phone, and finally he got over there, and we talked and talked and talked and talked, and he just drove me nuts. He just drove me nuts. And finally he says, I will call on you on Friday and take you to the meeting. And I said, look, I haven't decided to join this cult yet. It sounds to me like another religion, which we're loaded with them down south, you know. Everybody comes up with an idea, they start a cult. They start their own religion. And I said, this sounds just like it. Don't forget, AA wasn't very well known. And he said, get mad. And he wrote out the address. He says, I'll see you there Friday night. You know, this disease of alcoholism, when we stop and think of it, what the hell is it? Well, as far as I know, as far as I've learned all these 42 years, that we are allergic to alcohol, which is not such an unusual thing for people to be allergic to anything. My oldest daughter was allergic to the albumin of an egg. Now, mind you, and we thought she was having attacks of what's it called? She had no trouble. Now, that's a crazy thing, but that she was allergic to it. A lot of people are allergic to strawberries, allergic to cucumbers, they're allergic to lots of things. Allergic to horses, even, you know that? But we happen to be allergic to alcohol, and they say 10% of all the people in the world are allergic to alcohol. When we take a drink, it causes a compulsion beyond our control to continue drinking. And, of course, compulsion is beyond your control. Willpower has nothing to do with this at all. Compulsion will overrule willpower anytime. You see? So we say, why don't you stay sober on willpower? It's practically a human impossibility. I met one guy that stayed sober on willpower. He'd been sober 6 years when he came into AA. But I find out later that his wife, right after dinner, would lock him in his bedroom. When you ever stop to think it, we use willpower in very short spaces of time. You use your willpower to get off the pad in the morning. You don't use your willpower for that purpose anymore. You use your willpower to eat breakfast. You don't use your willpower for that purpose anymore. But to say I'm going to use my willpower to stay sober 24 hours a day, 60 minutes to the hour, is a fallacy. It's absolutely a fallacy. So we are allergic. We are allergic to alcohol. But what makes us take the first drink? Who knows what makes us take the first drink? I find out that we have certain defects of character. Emotional instability to the nth degree. All alcoholics are the same. Did you ever stop to think, well, I mean, did I get drunk because I was... Yeah, you got drunk when you went to the wedding, didn't you? You got drunk at somebody's birthday party. You got drunk when you went out to that nightclub. You got drunk on that side of the picture. Anything that got you upset emotionally, you got drunk. And on the other side, Uncle Jim died, you had to get drunk. I mean, the bad things that I have, the boss is a stinker, so you get drunk. And then you got fired, so you get drunk. I mean, anything that gets us upset emotionally, we get drunk. So that's the disease of alcoholism, a physical allergy coupled with emotional instability. We are so emotionally unstable in our drinking days that we deteriorate to the point where we're like little children. Any little thing will get us drunk. We're like the little child, 4 years old, laying on the floor and kicking his feet and crying. Emotionally upset. And that's just the way we were. But we knew the medicine. We'd go get a jug. See? So we wouldn't cry. We'd just go get the jug. And I find out that my fourth step kind of takes care of a lot of things for me. Maybe not for you, but for me. I found out all the alcoholics have certain defects of character. And they run very much in a parallel. And these certain defects of character that I have are the things that cause me to get emotionally upset. Right at the top of the list, I wrote it out. Self-pity, frustration. Oh, my God, how many times did I get drunk over that? I wasn't getting the right breaks. They didn't realize what a great man I was. Quack, 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 quack. Second worst defect of character that I have are resentments. How many times did I get drunk over resentments? Oh, my God, I can't count them. The third worst defect of character is intolerance. Intolerance of the way you do things. Intolerance of you. Intolerance of others. Another reason I got drunk. These are defects of character, but we all have. Every one of you damn drunks out there the same. We're all very, very selfish people. I'll never forget, and this is going way back, and I very seldom talk about this. They're having the big Fourth of July meeting over at the Coliseum in Los Angeles. We lived in the sort of a hill, and this is when I was still married to the intolerant one, you know? And I'm sitting up on the I wanted to take the kids out to the Coliseum, which I could have. It wasn't a couple miles. But I had a date to do some drinking with some friends of mine down at the bar, see, that night. So I take the kids to the top of this little hill, maybe 3 blocks from the house, so they could see the fireworks from there. They missed it all, you know. Selfish son of a bitch. That's what I was. Just a selfish, good-for-nothing guy. Took them back home. The kids got a happy fun. So that's the alcoholic. These are the defects of characters I find out that I'm loaded with. And in my daily life, I will always be an emotional person. We always. Who wants to be a vegetable, you know? My life is like this. I'm highs and lows. And even as of today, after 42 years, it's highs and lows in my life. It's a wonderful way to live. Crazy. I was so glad that they invited me to talk in my hometown, you can't believe it. Because we come up there every year, see tonight. We come up there and get a taste of heaven here in Coeur d'Alene. Come on down there and that snog and that crap, old boy, something. This year was the worst year I ever saw down there. It was about 90 to 100 all the time, and the humidity, mind you, with all that smog, was around 70. Hell, I'm just 91 years old. You know, you wouldn't expect that. No, I'm not 91. I thought you'd laugh about it. I'm just 81. Too wonderful. I whipped these kids in golf, too. A lot of them. Took some of them out yesterday, those guys. I'm right down the middle. 150 yards. They're way over in those trees, 240 yards. Well, anyway, I went to this first meeting on a Friday night. Well, this is the first meeting we went to, and I went to the door, and Cecilia was with me. I didn't have any. I was scared to death. After being drunk so long, I was scared of my shadow. You know, the terrible fear that we have. And the guy at the door says, you want to stay sober on an all-time basis? And I says, you betcha. He says, stand right over there. And I said, just a minute, I got a sponsor. And I gave him the name of the sponsor. He says, oh, didn't you hear about him? And he says, no. He says, he got drunk last night. I says, that's good. I didn't like him anyway. So we sat down in the front row, and the guy up here talking this night must have been a preacher because he was quoting the Bible and he was really going to town. That was the first meeting I went to. And I turned to the guy sitting next to me and I says, all this is a Main Street mission. All you need is sawdust on the floor. And this guy's preaching and preaching the Bible. And he said, oh, yeah, this is an awfully nice little guy. All these fellows are all dead now. And he says, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yeah. He says, you see all those guys over there? And I said, yeah. He says, they're all sober. I said, well, that's good. And he said, there's something about this thing that will keep you sober. He says, give yourself a break and stick around for the rest of this meeting. Come back to at least 8 meetings before you make up your mind. You can spare the time. And I said, yeah. So I stayed. You can't challenge an alcoholic. So I stayed. Thank God I met a guy by the name of Pete Cunningham that lived down in my section. And Pete kind of took over. And everything was just fine. I'm staying sober and I'm the happiest man in the world to find other people who have the same problems that I do. To find other people who have suffered like I did. To find other people who are at the very peak of their profession and fell flat on their fence. It was just wonderful to find other people who were trying to stay sober all the same way. And we were out making false step calls you wouldn't believe. They were coming in like it was just fantastic. So I get the old horn out and I start practicing and I get myself in shape in no time and I start calling all the managers, the orchestras at the different studios. And he says, that's wonderful, you're sober, Al. Don't call me, I'll call you. And I didn't get any word. And the first year I was sober was the toughest year I ever had financially in my life. And now I realize it was all God's will. If I had been embraced by all these people immediately because I was sober, the old ego would have just come right out. And I'd have been drunk again. And it was all God's will. It was all God's will that I didn't have a good bad year. It was all God's will of all the things that I went through. Someone was trying to tell me something all of those years, and my ego wouldn't let me listen. Everything in this world to me today is God's will. All I can do is the best that I can. Do what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it, and the rest is up to God. And we can drive for a certain target with all we've got.
And when you think we should have it, it disappears on us. That's God's will. You will find out later that you shouldn't have had what you were driving for. That's what we call faith of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do what you're supposed to do, and you're supposed to do it. Leave the rest up to God. And I was frantic. And I stood up at one of the meetings, and I says, I used to make more money when I was drinking. And one of the mean old bastards says, go back to drinking. I says, I don't want to. He says, okay, sit down and shut up and listen. So after about 6 months, I went to the leader of the group. His name was Frank Randall, this particular act. I said, Frank, do you know anybody in the music business? And he said, no, why? And I said, I need a job real bad, and I thought you might have an angle. He says, my boy, this is not an employment agency. This is a place to stay sober. He says, what's your number one problem? And I said, alcohol's my number one problem. He says, okay, take care of your number one problem and everything else will take care of itself. When it's supposed to. You might not get a job for 5 years the way you kick these people around, but you'll eat and you'll have a roof over your head. And from now on until they put you 6 foot under, worry about one thing, your number one problem. And you'll get everything in this world that you deserve, and most likely a lot more. Nothing was ever said that was ever better. There hasn't been a day gone by that I don't think of that. I've got one problem, and that's alcohol. If I take care of that problem, everything else will take care of itself. When it's supposed to. Not when I want it to, but when it's supposed to. It's the greatest little piece of advice I've ever had given to me. That's my problem. Accept what happened. Now, being a musician, I have an awful lot of friends in the music profession. I'm pretty proud of being a musician where I was. In those studios, because we are tops, absolute tops. They would write a piece of music, a manuscript. You've never heard, seen it, or will never see it again, and you sit down and you read it at sight with 60, 70 men. I mean, this is really something. Get all the balance in the whole works, really something. And there's a little piano player by the name of Fidgy. Fidgy McGrath was his name. I can use his name. He's dead now. And Fidgy stood about 5'6", 5'7", little guy, fat hand, played like an angel. He had a beautiful job at CBS on radio. Coast to coast, 15 minutes a day, 500 a week. Had a nice home in Santa Monica, a couple kids, a couple cars, a wonderful wife, the world with a tail. We all loved little Fifty, but you know, he started drinking. And in no time at all, he was a full-blown alcoholic. Of course, he lost his job, he lost his family, and now he's playing at these piano bars around town, 50 bucks a week in tips. And he's drunk all the time. Owns a tuxedo, a couple of stiff shirts, and that's all he got. No car, no nothing. He got a job way out in the south side of Los Angeles in a beautiful piano bar, and now he can't get back to town at 2 o'clock, so he had to find himself a room. He found himself a room for 10 bucks a week in the rear of a home. He went back to the piano bar, and he cased the whole neighborhood, and he found that from the piano bar over to his home, he could take a shortcut to a little cemetery, a little winding path to this little cemetery. So every morning at 2 o'clock, he's drunk as $1,000. And he follows his path through there, and he's home in 10 minutes, never got into trouble. But this particular morning, he's very, very drunk, and it's cold, and it's raining. And he starts through this little cemetery, and my God, he got off the path, and he fell in a hole. It was dug for a funeral the next day. And there's poor little Fidgy. At the bottom of this hole, he can't get out. He's so short, he can't reach the top of the hole, and he's screaming and hollering all night long. Sounded like a Comanche. About down an old rhino come wandering through this cemetery, and he hears the song. He wandered around the cemetery and finally found a little guy down at the bottom of the hole. Now, Fidgy had given up. He was spread eagle out at the bottom of the hole. The rhino says, what's the matter down there? Fidgy says, get me out of here, I'm freezing to death. Get me out of here, I'm freezing to death. And the rhino looked at him a minute and he said, no wonder you're freezing to death. You've kicked all your dirt off. At the Melrose Grotto on a Friday afternoon where all the musicians hung out at, and we all would get there Friday afternoon, a big long bar with stools, so that, you know, we can get the poop for what's going to happen the following week in the studio. I freelance most of the time. I wouldn't sign a contract till after I got sober. One of the guys sitting next to me mentioned me, he says, look, it comes through the door, and here comes Fidgy. Fidgy looked like death warmed over. Oh, my God. Puke got over himself. He torn his clothes. He looked, it was terrible. He pulled himself up on the stool of the bar. He started hitting the bar, and he says, "John, bartender John, give me a drink, John. You know I'm the best damn piano player in the world. Just give me a drink, John." Finally, one of the musicians said to him, "Fitz, there's a piano over there. Let's hear you play anything, you see. Play anything. Well, let's hear you play anything." And Fitz says, "I'll just show you." So he started for the piano. My God, when he turned around, the seat of his pants were off and his ass was hanging out. And the bartender saw this, and he ran around to the end of the bar, just as Fitzy sat down. And he says, "Fitzy, do you know your ass is hanging out?" And Fitzy looked at him a minute, and he said, "No, but you just sing a few bars, and I'll follow you."
Diagnosed why you can't see.
It'll mean an operation. And the boy says, let's go. So they went to the hospital. He operated on this boy, and he laid up in his bed in the hospital, perfectly still, with bandages over his eyes, for exactly 23 days. When the doctor called up the family, he says, tomorrow we will find out whether this operation was a success or not. And here's the whole family standing around the bed. The doctor slowly took these bandages off the boy's eyes. When he got them completely off his eyes, the boy opened his eyes, and my God, he could see light. And he could see the doctor, and he could see his family, and he grabbed the doctor by the hand, and he said, doctor, I don't know how to thank you. I just don't know how to thank you. The doctor says, don't thank me. All I did was put in the stitches. And God took care of the rest. In Alcoholics Anonymous, all we do is put in the stitches, and God takes care of the rest. Be good to yourself, and God bless you.